It's commonly said that Muslims and Christians basically worship the same God, or that all the Abrahamic faiths are essentially the same. Even Joe Biden last year said in a pre-election speech that we all come from the same root here in terms of our fundamental basic beliefs, end quote. But do we? Is Allah just the Arabic word for the Christian God? If so, how do you explain the seeming extreme differences in how we live out our faith? And if not, how can we be better equipped to engage our Muslim neighbors? We're going to be talking about all of that and much more on today's episode of Theology on Air. Well, welcome back to Theology on Air. We're so glad to have you guys joining us. Theology on Air, as you many know, is an offshoot of Theology on Tap, which is a ministry here in Houston for young adults where we come around craft beer and fascinating ideas around philosophy, theology, faith, and culture. And then in the podcast, we get to go more deeply, weekly content, and talk about headlines, talk about ideas, spar a little bit more. It's great. And so I am Sarah Stone. I am the outreach director for young adults at MDPC on the west side of town, joined as always by Evan McClanahan, senior pastor at First Lutheran in Midtown. And today we're joined by, all the way across the pond from Scotland, our guest, Andy Bannister. Andy is the director of the Solas Center for Public Christianity, speaker, author, and broadcaster. He's the co-host of Pod of the Gaps, such a clever name. I'm jealous I didn't think of it. He's the husband to Astrid, father to, is it Katrina?
Katrina, you got
I thought so. It's not how we spell it here in the States, but I got it. And Christopher, and he is an avid mountain climber. So what's the most difficult mountain you've climbed?
Well, the first thing is I'm disappointed there is no craft beer. All I get is air. So we were going to ship it, but we figured
Scotland has pretty good beer on its own. So
actually we do. And the whiskey is very good as well. The hardest mountain I've climbed, that's interesting. Well, the hardest mountain I got halfway up was I got to Everest Base Camp on the Tibetan side in 2007. And that was pretty hard, actually, because just the altitude. And then on your part of the world, we love the High Sierra Mountains. And so Mount Dana up on the High Sierras above Yosemite Valley. I mean, that's, again, altitude, really. And then we've got some quite technical stuff here in Scotland, stuff that if you know maybe smaller than what you've got in the States, but if you fall off it will still kill you. So we have lots of like lovely knife edge bridges, and we're coming into winter, so the ice axe and the crampons are getting dusted off. So it's good fun.
And does that make your wife nervous that you're doing these dangerous things, or does she go with you?
Well, funny thing is, ever since she like doubled the life insurance policy the other year, she's been encouraging me to do more ice climbing. So I think everybody wins.
So that's a little bit about Andy, is that regardless of what you're writing or speaking on, he brings humor to it, which is, I think, why I fell in love with the first book, at least the first book I read of yours, which is The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, where you kind of talk about different obstacles to faith, and you give really, it's a very approachable book. Oh, perfect. Mine's in my office. So yeah, there it is. It gives a lot of stories and like metaphors and illustrations about things. Like I like the one about the police lineup, like, you know, Christianity is just one God different from all the other options out there. And you said something about a police lineup. One of them just a little bit different, but it's really important, that difference, you know, like maybe he committed a crime. So definitely check that book out. It's full of humor and, but also really good apologetics. So, but today we're going to be mostly talking about your latest book, which is Do Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God? And you have quite a background in studying Islam. So maybe just start by telling us a little bit about you, about your own story, maybe of faith and how you got interested. I mean, I know because I read the book, but our listeners don't yet in this to begin with.
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. Thanks for having me on the show as well, by the way. So my background was I grew up in a Baptist church in London, and really, by the time I got to my mid-20s, hadn't thought about apologetics, hadn't thought about Muslims, hadn't really thought about defending my faith. I just sort of muddled through, really. And then one day a guy came to our church and did a seminar on Islam and reaching Muslims. And he was an American, in fact. So there we go. So always blame the Americans. That's what we like to do over here. And he was a very persuasive speaker. And in particular, he shared how every Sunday afternoon he was going to one of our big parks in London called Hyde Park, and a place called Speaker's Corner. It's part of the park where you can stand on a ladder and talk about anything, religion, politics, sport, get a crowd. And he'd found there were lots of Muslims there. So he was preaching to the Muslims. And we got talking after his seminar. And during the course of that conversation, he said, Andy, why don't you come to Speaker's Corner next week and see what we do? So I did. I went up to London the following weekend, met him at the train station, and he had two ladders with him. And I went, why have you got two ladders, Jay? He went, well, one is for me to preach on and one's for you to preach on, Andy. I said, mate, you said come and see what we do. He went, oh, the best view is up a ladder. I went, I've never preached on the street. He went, oh, it's easy. It's so easy. I said, I've never talked to Muslims before. Oh, they are the easiest people to talk to. It's fine. Both those things, Sarah, were wrong. Spectacularly, epically wrong, because I got on the ladder and the Muslims had lots of questions and challenges to my faith. I'd never thought about any of them. And I remember sort of getting down from the ladder thinking, well, I need to become a Muslim, I guess, because they had everything. I had nothing. Following day, went to the local Christian bookstore, thinking I probably ought to at least do a little bit of sort of research before doing anything that quite that stupid. And the guy behind the counter heard my story and he said, well, Andy, you need apologetics. And it was the first time I'd ever heard that word. It sounded like a breakfast cereal, actually something sort of healthy you have for first thing in the morning. And he sold me a few books and I read those and I kept reading, went back to Speaker's Corner 2 weeks later, answers to every question they had asked me. And they had new questions. And yeah. I looked stupid in public all over again. But for the next 3 months, we kind of did this little exercise. I would read during the weeks. I'd go to Speaker's Corner on the weekend. And over that time, God did a number of things, really. He gave me a love of sharing my faith in public, a love of defending it and persuasively explaining it, and a love of Muslims, actually, and engaging with them and their questions. And kind of one thing led to another. That eventually led to theological college, and that led to a PhD in Islam. So it all started up a ladder on a rainy afternoon in a London park, preaching on the street.
I love it.
Is that Jay Smith?
Yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wondered if you were people who know Jay put two and two together.
See,
I was Jay. So yeah, American missionary to the UK for about 25 years. He's now back on your side. Jay, absolutely fearless and learned huge amounts from him. He's inspired many of us into that field.
Yeah, I heard him on Unbelievable as well. I'd mentioned that I'd heard of Andy before on Unbelievable. And I'll just say this quickly, and I know we have other questions, but one of the things he would say that has always stuck with me is that when you're engaging Muslims, you have to give it as fiercely as they you know, bring it, right? Like you go toe to toe or they don't respect you. And I thought that was interesting because when you think about the apologetic sort of venture generally, I find that Christians also, they always, whether it's people of another faith or unbelievers or whatever the case may be, it's like, we always want to be so nice because we want to be charitable and da, 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 da. And I always wonder, like, but do any of them respect us? You know, because we seem so, sometimes so sort of tepid and mild mannered in the way we go about it. So it was kind of nice that he was sort of giving permission to, like, no, it's okay. You can be bold and, you know, don't be afraid or they won't respect you in the morning, sort of thing. So
that's interesting. No,
I totally, just on that very point, I completely agree. Because to go, I think firstly, a couple of things very quickly. If you look at the New Testament, we have that model demonstrated. Perhaps a really good example would be if you look at in the book of Acts, where Paul is in Ephesus, he rents the lecture hall of Tyrannus, we're told. And for 2 years, he debates, he contends with Jews and the pagans. And clearly what is meant is he's not sitting down having a little tea party. He's actually having debates, public debates. You've got Jesus and the Pharisees to some extent. Again, be careful quite totally how we apply that model, because of course he was the Lord and we're not. But nevertheless, he still was quite willing to let rip. What I would say, I think, is even when we're engaging with our friends, with our colleagues, with our, you know, next door neighbors in a context where perhaps we wouldn't be having a huge public debate, we need to not learn to be afraid to A, be confident in what we believe and be challenged. You know, I always say to people, be willing to be challenged yourself. It's perfectly okay for atheists, for Muslims to ask us questions, but also turn the tables and say, okay, I've answered your questions for a while. Now I've got some for you. And push back. You don't have to be loud and forceful. You could just be clear and firm. You can ask good questions. But yeah, we mustn't just be people who are so nice that we never actually challenge the alternative worldviews out there. We're called to respect people. We're not called to respect other belief systems. Mm.
Makes me think of Nabil Qureshi, one of my favorite apologists, tragically passed away a few years ago. But he talks about, you know, he was kind of an apologist, or his parents were, for Islam for a long time. And a girl in, I want to say like high school or college, presented the gospel to him, and he just like decimated her arguments, and she went away, you know, so sad. And she, I mean, she was like wholly unprepared to do what she was trying to do. But he said in retrospect, even though she had weak arguments, she tried. And where were all the other Christians trying? And he would say, like, if they really believe what they thought was true, why weren't all my Christian friends talking to me? Why were they, you know, just being sort of nice and respectful? Like, I want them to say what they believe because it's the power to save. Of course, he said that on the on the end of things where he had converted. But
I think you're absolutely right. Sorry, let me carry on.
No, I love that story. And I mean, yeah, it's just an encouragement for all of us to be bold. Okay, but this question comes up. It literally came up at the dinner table less than a week ago with some friends of mine, a friend who's dating somebody who's Muslim. And he was saying to her, well, we basically worship the same God. And I said, oh, we're doing a podcast on this. So the name of the book is Do We Serve the Same or Do We Worship the Same God? So just in a nutshell, and then we're going to kind of break it down. Do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? Well, I know there's sort of a quick and dirty answer.
But it is. The funny thing is, Sarah, when this book came out, I got like, I got sort of two sort of divergent comments on social media. I had one group of people saying to me, why on earth do you need it to write an entire book? To which the answer is obviously no. And then other people very cross to me saying, well, why do you need to write a book when the answer is obviously yes?
Oh, funny. And you're like, that's why.
Said, well, given that the other crowd think the opposite to you, clearly there's a discussion to be had.
Yeah.
And I do think that you know, that I land largely on the no position. I'd be slightly cheeky. I'd say the answer is 90% no and maybe 10% yes. But those answers need unpacking. To begin with the yes, unpack that very briefly, and we can unpack it a bit more. I think if you break the question down and say, okay, let's look at how the Quran describes God. Let's look at what the Quran, the scripture of Islam, says about God. Does it line up with what the Bible says about God? Is there some overlap? No overlap? How close are they? Well, the answer is they are spectacularly different. They are worlds apart. So I think it is categorically clear that the Quran is not describing the same God as the God of the Bible. The other part of it, though, it's always important to mention, I've come across many Muslims who say to me things like, well, you know, I believe in a God of love. Now, the Quran doesn't describe Allah as a God of love. But rather than say to that Muslim, no, you got it totally wrong, you need to read your Quran, I want to do what Paul does in Acts 17, where the altars of the unknown God, where he's walking around Athens, if you remember, sees the altars of the unknown God, and he doesn't then lecture the Athenians on their stupid paganism. He says, oh, I saw this altar to an unknown God. Hey, let me tell you about that God. And he bridge builds. And so when I meet Muslims who are perhaps closer to Christianity than others because of what they're drawn to in the kind of God that they're reaching out to, I want to sort of reach out and say, yeah, you know what? Come on home. You are halfway there. But the God I think you're looking for is the God of the Bible. And you mentioned Nabil, who is a, you know, dear friend of mine. And I love the title of his book, you know, the book about his testimony, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. So he wanted intimacy with God. He went searching for that, couldn't find it in the Quran, obviously, but it's just a beautiful story that the God that he ended up searching for was actually the God he'd written off when he went attacking Christians all those years before. So he went searching for Allah and found Jesus. It's a brilliant title and it's an amazing story.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the 10% yes.
And that's the 90% no. So 10% is there are some Muslims who are much closer, more like, yeah, the Acts 17 sort of folks. And let's just, yeah, let's invite them home. Let's build those bridges. But the Quran, yeah, I have absolutely no time for the idea that the Quran is even remotely describing that, you know, a God like the God of the Bible. And we can unpack that more if you like.
Sure.
Can I make a quick question, maybe a distinction as well? Yes, dive right in. The title of the book is Worship. And I know sometimes people will sort of quibble over whether we believe in the same God, whether we worship the same God. I don't know how much the difference is that you could argue that we believe in the same God in the sense that they're come from the Abrahamic tradition. There is only one God, but Christians worship the fully Trinitarian revealed God. So I don't know if that's a sort of distinction worth making.
Yeah.
But
well, that's a great observation. That's a great way into the bigger issue. So let me just say a couple of things and then you can kind of push back or tease out things that intrigue you guys. One of the things that Christians will often do, Evan, is when we think about this question, we'll often leap for the Trinity. We'll say, well, okay, you know, Muslims can't be worshipping or even believing in, you know, potentially the same God as we do because of the Trinity or because of Jesus. Because obviously as Christians, we always go to Jesus, right? My six-year-old, when we're doing family Bible time, I ask any question, the answer is always Jesus, because that's the default go-to position. The problem with that, while that's wonderful, and of course, you know, Jesus is the center of the biblical story, if we say Muslims and Christians worship a different God because they don't have Jesus, the problem is then, of course, we've also cut off our Jewish friends. Our Jewish friends don't believe in Jesus. And I don't think, you know, if you could grab a time machine and go back and interview the Apostle Paul and went, right, okay, so Paul, you're pretty convinced, you know, that the Jewish people aren't worshiping the real God, right? Paul would go, what have you been smoking? Mm. That is clearly not what the New Testament is saying. So we need a slightly more sophisticated answer. And I think the more sophisticated answer, and I explore this in the book, is to say, well, okay, if we look at the characteristics of the God of the Bible, how the Bible describes God, because the Bible is not primarily interested in the question, is there a God? You know, as the book of James says, right, you know, even the demons believe in God and tremble. The question the Bible is not interested in is there a God? That's assumed. The question is, what is God like? Mm-hmm. And there are a number of core characteristics, I think, of the Bible's answer to that question. God is a God who's relational. He relates to human beings and the person of Jesus, you know, stepping into space and time. But in the Old Testament, he relates too. He walks in the garden with Adam and Eve. He appears at the burning bush to Moses. He appears to Abraham. He speaks directly to his prophets and sometimes to his people face to face, in the case of Moses, we're told. He's a God who can be known. The whole invitation of the Bible is not just know about God, you know him. In fact, you know, passages, that famous verse in Jeremiah that says, you know, let not the wise boast in their wisdom, the strong boast in their strength, but the one who boasts in this, that they understand and know me. So the whole cry of the Bible is that a call of the Bible is to know God. God is in the Bible is also a God who is holy. He doesn't just command, you know, right and wrong. He is goodness itself. He is a God who is utterly just, utterly righteous, utterly holy. He's a God who is love. First John tells us God is love. And again, we see that in both Old and New Testament, that characteristic of God. And then lastly, God is a God who suffered, most famously in Jesus. But in the Old Testament, too, we read of God grieving and being moved deeply by the situation that humanity has got itself into. So those five characteristics are all over the Bible. They are seen the most clearly in Jesus, but they're in the Old Testament too. So central to the Jewish conception of God. Turn to the Quran, and every single one of those five conceptions is either outrightly rejected or simply airbrushed out of the picture and replaced with another. The God of the Quran is not relational. You cannot know him. He is not a God who is holy. He is not a God who is love. He is not a God who has suffered. And taking that approach, I think, is helpful because it opens up a broader conversation around what God is like. It includes our Jewish friends in the discussion. Yeah, we want to point them to Jesus, but we're not saying, boy, everything you think about God is wrong. But it also, I think, focuses on some of the massive differences. Because the other one last thing, and then pass back to you folks. You know, the one assumption, and I think you hinted at it, Evan, was something you said, it's often assumed that Islam is an Abrahamic faith. I would say a lot of the more recent scholarship on Islam would say it isn't an Abrahamic faith. It's built out of Abrahamic pieces because when Muhammad was building the early religion of Islam, he looked around him and among the religious traditions and ideas circulating around Arabia were Jewish and Christian ideas because those groups were there. And then like a child working with Lego building blocks, you know, he took those pieces and built something out of them. But there is no connection between really the theological system underpinning Islam with Judaism and Christianity. It's an Arabian faith, not a Jewish and Christian faith. And I think I say that not to insult Islam. The danger is if we don't put that distance there, we don't understand it properly. We try and squeeze it into our framework. And so there's been a lot of really good scholarship in recent years, I think, really showing just how different Islam actually is on almost every sort of category you can think of. Sorry, that was a very long answer, but I know it was.
No, it was a great answer. It's actually the answer to my sixth question that I had. So we're just going to jump around. It's great.
Oh, fantastic. We're just burning through them tonight. That's right. Great.
Well, you went through those characteristics in one of the later chapters of your book. And so my sort of follow-up question, kind of playing devil's advocate, is if the God of the Quran is not holy and is not love, how do you respond to this idea that, you know, when you talk to somebody about kind of one of the core differences between Christianity and Islam is this idea of how do you sort of get to heaven, right? Christianity says you're doomed to begin with. You need Jesus. You will never be good enough. Islam, it's my understanding, says if your good outweighs your bad, you're in. But also Allah is merciful. This is the whole thing. Allah is merciful. He's love. So even if you're like close, maybe you'll get in or maybe he'll have mercy on you. But if he's not holy and he's not love, then how can there be any trust that you'll make it in, especially when you probably don't have good outweighing bad?
So many good things in those questions. Let's start with the holiness piece for a minute. You're absolutely right. I mean, Islam in essence sort of says the problem with human beings is that we are forgetful. God wants us to behave a particular way. Here are the commands he would like you to obey as human beings. But you know what? Human beings are weak and forgetful. We mess it up. So you know what? Here's the Quran. Have some more commandments. And it's interesting that Islam never changes the script. God's law is sent. Human beings break it. So more law is sent. But the idea is still that if you try and keep enough of it, you might work your way upwards to heaven. Two problems I would say with that. Firstly, you know, trying to solve the problem of our inability to keep the commands by sending more commands is like seeing somebody drowning in a river and offering to help by tossing them a bucket of water. They've got enough of the wet stuff. They actually need rescue. So the Quran just sends more of the same. And also look in the Quran where it places the emphasis. It places it on us. And of course, if you've earned your way to heaven by good deeds, then actually that doesn't make you grateful or Allah being one who's forgiving. Really, it means that you have earned your own salvation and you approach God, quite frankly, as somebody waving a receipt saying, you know what, you owe me because I've done all these things for you. Not somebody who is humble and saying, gosh, I need to cast myself on your mercy. And even if you did cast yourself on God's mercy and Allah simply forgives you, you still got the issue of what do you do about the injustice that's been done? You know, if you murder someone and you're brought before the judge and the judge goes, you know what, I'm feeling merciful today, I'm just going to let you off. I mean, wonderful. He or she's been a merciful judge, but you've got all of those who've been hurt and wronged by the injustice. The injustice hasn't been dealt with. And you've got not just mercy, you've got injustice, quite frankly. And the same is true of God. If God merely forgives and doesn't deal with the underlying sin and rebellion, then he's not a God who is just or holy. And that's one of the problems of the God of the Quran. He's not a God who's holy. He's a God who's fairly arbitrary. You know, he plays a sort of game with us with which rules he'd have us keep or not keep, you know, how the system is scored. You can never really know how you're doing and so on and so forth. That's the first thing. And then second thing, mercy is interesting. The Quran doesn't really talk about the love of God. The word love is used in connection with the word Allah in the Quran about 42 times. The majority of those are negative. The Quran telling you who God doesn't love. You know, if you behave a certain way, God won't love you. And the other ones telling you if you do behave a certain way, then God might love you. It's all conditional. There's no sort of unconditional love in the Quran. But love is a fairly kind of sort of loose word, I think, there in the Quran. It doesn't have the depth of the biblical word, such that many, in fact, Quran specialists have said that the word love in the Quran, we better translate as like or approve of, actually. Allah approves of these things. He doesn't approve of these things. Now, because the Quran is so reticent to speak of God's love, those who want to squish the two religions together have often tried to play the game of saying, well, the Quran talks lots about God's mercy. And it does talk a lot about God's mercy. The Allah is the merciful one. It's one of the most common names of God in the Quran. And so you come across, say, perhaps a Christian theologian like Miroslav Volf, well-known Christian theologian, wrote a book called Allah, A Christian Response, a few years ago to try and squeeze the two religions together and say it's the same God. And that's his move. He says, well, mercy and love are the same. But of course, they're not. A moment's thought would tell you that you can be merciful to something without any emotional connection. You know, the house we live in here in Scotland is in the, not so much now, they're building around this. When we bought it, it was on the edge of fields. And for the first couple of winters here, in the winter, we'd often get little furry visitors in the house. Little mice would come in. And I used to just trap the little suckers and, you know, throw them in the garbage. But my kids rebelled and insisted I buy humane mouse traps, which are little plastic tubes that you can trap the mouse in, not realize it's there and let the thing starve to death. But in theory, you're supposed to trap it and release so it can then come back into the house a day later. So I would show mercy to the mouse at the insistence of my children. Trust me, I didn't love the little critter. There was no love involved. There was simply, okay, I'm actually not going to kill it this time. You can be merciful and utterly cold. There is no emotional connection. Mercy is not the same as love. They are utterly different. I think love, a good definition of love actually, is when, that's a movie actually, isn't it? Love Actually. Good definition of love is when you invest of yourself or you give sacrificially to another, which of course is why Jesus gave his definition of love, where he said, greater love has nobody than they lay down their life for their friends. That is the ultimate example of love. Love is by its nature costly. And if it hasn't cost you something, I'm not really sure it's true love.
Go ahead.
Speaking of love, there's this kind of philosophical argument that love is possible in the understanding of the Christian God, because God is tripersonal. And so you can't love without having another person to love. And there would have been a time when Allah would have existed, you know, alone. And I guess still in a way exists alone as the only God. But is that a good argument to talk about love, or is that kind of silly and abstract? You know, is the tri-personal nature of God needing an object to love, therefore God can be love because it's part of his eternal characteristics, that sort of thing? Is that somewhere you would go?
I think I would, if you're dealing with somebody who can understand it. If you're dealing sometimes perhaps with the person in the street, the Muslim in the street, you are heading into the edge of philosophy. But I think it's a very good argument, Evan. I've used it over the years with certain, particularly I'm dealing with perhaps more academic Muslims, and just flesh that out for folks who perhaps aren't familiar, because you went through it at high speed, because obviously you're a learned theologian, a philosopher, and think these things all the time.
Very much so.
I love the fact that Sarah's giving you that look.
Well, he actually is, but I also like to tease him. Yeah,
there we go. So now where are we? So yes, exactly. So love requires, at the very least, it requires subject and an object. You can't simply be loving. Love requires someone who is doing the love and someone who's receiving the love. So there's at least two persons required for love to be meaningful. Now, interestingly, there was, I think, from memory, 15th, possibly 16th century Christian theologian who took things a little bit further, actually, and said, actually, the most perfect, highest form of love actually requires three persons. Because even, you know, one person trying to love, you can't do it. Requires another. If you just, you know, love, just be loving is kind of meaningless. Two persons, though, can become a little bit selfish. We've all perhaps had that experience of perhaps we knew sort of some friends at church. Those two friends met each other and fell in love. And at the moment they fell in love, they forgot the rest of the world existed. You know, they had no time for anybody else other than staring, you know, sort of dewy-eyed into each other's eyes. And it can become, love can become very, could turn inwards. But the highest form of love, said Richard, is when that shared love for one another is turned outwards and embraces another. The most obvious example would be parenthood, that lots of people, when they're married, have that experience of actually marriage becomes much richer when the love between husband and wife is then shared with another. And that's quite a sophisticated argument to show that actually that the purest form of love is threefold. And of course, there are three persons in the Trinity. So I think you can explore that, Evan, definitely. The way you can go at a more popular level is the way I intimated an answer to, I think, my question to what Sarah talked about previously. We talked about, you know, love being self-sacrificial. You know, I always like to say to people when we talk about God and love that, look, the word love is used very cheaply. We talk about, you know, that we love our countries, we love our jobs, we love our phones, we love our car. The word love is thrown around. So we need to really flesh out a little bit what we mean when we talk about love. So what's the highest form of love you could possibly imagine? Now, I find whether you ask Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, our secular friends, everybody very quickly gets to the Jesus answer, self-sacrificial love. That's why we love stories of people laying down their lives for another, parent who gives their life for a child, someone in the military who gives his or her life to save the fellow platoon if there's an attack or whatever. History is full of those stories. Self-sacrifice we recognize as a supreme virtue. So almost everyone gets very quickly to the Jesus answer. And then you could say, well, now that's interesting. Because if God were a God of love, whether we're talking about, you know, Islam or Christianity, whatever, if God were a God of love, then God, by his very nature, anything he does is the greatest example of that thing. God is the greatest creator. God is the greatest judge, and so on and so forth. He's not somewhere lower down the list. He is the greatest of all of those things. So if God is a God who loves, he must, by definition, have demonstrated the highest form of love, because otherwise any one of us could give our life for somebody else and outlove God. So then, where has God demonstrated self-sacrificial love? I don't see the God of Islam having done that. I do see the God of the Bible having done that. And then you are straight into Romans 5, verse 8, which one of my favorite verses as an evangelist. You know, God demonstrates his love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't just give his life for us. He gave his life for us when we were still his sinners, while we were his enemies, while we wanted nothing to do with him. He laid down his life for us, the greatest form of love by the greatest being in the universe. And that's the God of the Bible. It's not the God of the Quran. And again, if you know Nabil Qureshi's testimony, that idea was central to him coming to faith when he realized that the cross, which he thought was an example of weakness, he suddenly had this great epiphany when he realized, no, it's not. It's the complete opposite. It's a sign of total strength and utter power that God is so great that he could do that, even when we're far from him.
Man, golly, that's so inspiring. So we're talking about theology here, but I wonder if we can pivot a little bit just to a quick kind of history lesson, because when you just said the thing about Jesus, I think, you know, Muslims, if I understand correctly, think that Jesus was a prophet, but they don't think he was God because, you know, the whole Trinity problem. But maybe before we get to the Jesus thing, maybe you can just, I realize this is a huge undertaking, but maybe just give a kind of quick overview of just the history of Islam, right? I mean, we're hundreds of years past the beginning of the church. Muhammad comes on the scene. Maybe tell us a little bit about Muhammad, the writing of the Quran, who Jesus is, and then what the heck is the difference between the Quran and the Hadith? I know it's just a small matter. And
basically, what you want me to do is I teach a kind of week long introduction to Islam that I do for several kind of sort of seminaries as part of their master's program. So you wanted me to do a 38 hour kind of master's level introduction to Islam in about 3 minutes. No, no problem at all. I've had a caffeine.
Perfect. Great. I'm glad we asked.
So in a nutshell, let's start with Muhammad because one of the problems is I think when everyone thinks about Islam today, where do you start? And so many issues, it's good to start with Muhammad, you know, around issues around sort of, you know, peace and violence in Islam. Don't start with the Quran, start with Muhammad and so on. So anyway, so Muhammad, the founder of Islam, you know, born there in the late 6th century in Arabia, according to Islamic tradition, in Mecca. He's interested in spiritual things, according to the Islamic traditions. And according to, again, to Islamic tradition, I don't believe this, but I'm just telling you what Muslims believe, that sometime AD 610 AD, Muhammad has this encounter with the angel Gabriel and believes that God is revealing to him through Gabriel instructions for a new scripture and a new religion with him, Muhammad, in charge of it. And over the next 23 years, between 610 and 632 AD, Muhammad has these repeated encounters with Gabriel, where more and more of the Quran is revealed to him. And then after his death, those are edited together, published as what we now know today as the Quran. And off the back of that, and out of the community that Muhammad formed, the religion of Islam grows and develops and becomes, of course, not merely one of the world's great faith traditions, but also a great empire, because Muhammad, as well as being a prophet and a religious figure, was also a statesman and a war leader. And again, I don't say that to be negative or pejorative. That was simply what he was. He led many battles in his lifetime. He had a vision for uniting the kind of disparate warring tribes of Arabia and building a nation out of them, and he succeeded in that. And Islam, of course, became one of the world's great colonizing empires. I often think it's ironic that the Brits, we always get in the neck for our empire building, and quite rightly, I suppose. But Islam was another great empire building kind of operation. And so now, a couple of things here. Muhammad, when he was preaching and teaching the Quran, I alluded to this earlier, I think Muhammad got it into his head, the way you build a people together is they need a religion. You know, he was very depressed that his people were scattered and tribes. But if you looked around him to the north and the west of Arabia, you had the Byzantine Empire. They were Christian. To the north and east, you had the Persians, who were Zoroastrian. And so Muhammad gets into his head. He needs to give his people a religion. He needs to give his people a book. And he begins sort of fishing from this pool of religious traditions that Arabia is saturated in, particularly biblical traditions, because there was a lot of that stuff circulating around the Arabia of Muhammad's day in oral form, because Arabia is a culture where writing hadn't yet really made much inroad. And so that's why there's all these bits of biblical tradition there in the Quran, including Jesus, who we'll come to in a moment. And so when Muhammad dies in 632 AD, he's succeeded by a line of caliphs who then take what Muhammad did and build upon it, and particularly sort of get that military impetus going, and that sees Islam expand out of Arabia. And then Islamic theology and tradition begins developing. And over the next few centuries, that's where we see other writings alongside the Quran develop. You mentioned the Hadith. That's the collection of things that Muhammad said and did. And his lifetime, there are different sort of collections of those. That all happened in that period as Islam was formed. And actually, many Muslims are not aware of this. You know, Islam did not drop from the sky fully formed in the life of Muhammad. Islamic theology developed over the centuries after Muhammad's death, as did Christian theology, as Christians wrestled with the things in their scripture, Muslims wrestled with the things in their scripture. So Islam has a history. So that's a kind of, you know, 3.5 minute version of the potted history of the beginnings of Islam.
And modern day Muslims do have disagreements. I mean, we say Islam, just like when you say Christianity, there are differences, there are different you know, Shia and Sunni and that sort of thing. And that's only relevant because sadly, Islam is often in the news for reasons that most Muslims would not want Islam in the news, for some act of terrorism or some war going on or something like that. But just as one example, it was said that when ISIS was at the height of its power, for example, that they would first go after the Christians, but the next group would be the Muslims that they disagreed with. Mm. You know, so yes. I just as kind of a placeholder that that even when we talk about Muslim, there are these different traditions that develop. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you could argue that Islam actually sort of bifurcated right at the very beginning, because when Muhammad died in 632 AD, he died quite suddenly. Muslim community was not expecting his death, and so there'd been no plan for succession. Muhammad didn't leave a male heir. It's actually interesting that he married or had sexual relations with something like 23 different women over his life, if you piece the stories together from the hadith, but failed to produce a male heir, so there was no successor when he died. And the Muslim community split over that. There were one group of Muslims who thought that the kind of, you know, closest companions of Muhammad should pick the caliph to lead the community. And there was another group who thought, well, the closest they had to a male heir, Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, that he should be the leader of the community. So that's the closest thing you got to bloodline succession. And there was a big sort of internal dispute over that. Ali's party, who were the Shia, which is abbreviation for Shia Ali, the party of Ali, they lost out. And the Sunnis, who were the group who thought you should, you know, pick a leader by consensus, they won. And the first three caliphs were Sunni. And then finally, Ali gets to the throne as number four in line. But by that point, there's been assassinations, bitter recriminations, and actually the civil war then breaks out. That actually ends up with the grandsons of Muhammad getting killed at the Battle of Karbala in the modern-day Middle East. And of course, that division between Sunni and Shia comes down to the present day, and it has implications in the Middle East today, because Iran, largely Shiite, Iraq was largely Sunni, and of course we had the Iran-Iraq war and other things, and now of course you've got Iran, largely Shia, jostling for supremacy with Saudi Arabia, largely Sunni. And we often miss in the West that actually, really, you know, when Iran's saber rattles and, you know, launches threats, particularly at the Americans, a big part of that is they're not actually threatening you guys. They're scoring points around the rest of the Muslim world. Mm. They're trying to play. We are the defenders of Islam. It's not the Saudis. We are the big leader. You know, we are the ones who should be leading the Muslim community. So, yes, all those issues come down to the present day. But still the issue of extremism, and you're absolutely right. Many Muslims would look at, say, what ISIS are doing and have done over the years, and then Al-Qaeda and so forth before them with horror. But even then, with the absolute greatest respect, I always want to say to Muslims who have that reaction, okay, I totally get that this is something you find abhorrent, but we have to talk about Muhammad for a moment, because the problem is that, of course, the folks, the ISIS guys, have in their eyes very good theological justification. There's a very famous article actually in the Atlantic magazine a few years ago called What ISIS Really Wants, written by Graham Wood, who's just a secular journalist. And that's a brilliant long read, 20-page article, where he just actually went through all of the ISIS literature, because they tell you what they believe. They put a glossy magazine out. They were doing that one, several times a year. And he points out that all of their behaviors and practices, they root in the life of Muhammad. As he described, they are a prophetic movement. And his challenge in that article is that it's not enough for moderate Muslims to go, we don't like this. They have to deal with some of the awkward issues around Muhammad and his behavior. And Nabil Qureshi, actually, we mentioned Nabil a couple of times. Nabil wrote a follow-up book to Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, his book Answering Jihad. And he talks in that book that one of the things that led him out of Islam was not just he was attracted to Jesus, was the issue of violence. And he says, I looked at the sources for Muhammad's life and some of the things that Muhammad did. He said, I came rapidly to the realization I had one of three choices. I could either become an extremist like ISIS and just take those texts seriously. I could either walk away and abandon Islam, or I could try all kinds of justifications in my head why I didn't really mean what it said on the page and so on. And he said, I tried route three at first. And he said, I couldn't live with a cognitive dissonance, that actually the text said one thing, but in my heart said something else. And it was then ultimately, you know, that attraction to Jesus, the man of peace. Now, I say we want to say that with we want to be gentle in that with our Muslim friends, not be triumphalistic, not try and score points or make out that we think that, you know, the West is superior to Islam or any of those horrific routes the Christians can go. But we do want to draw the distinction between Muhammad, who was a man of war, and Jesus, who is a man of peace, and not be afraid of that distinction.
Yeah, you said in your podcast, like I said earlier, there was a question. I couldn't think how to write it in a way that was, diplomatic. But you said moderate Muslims are very different from Islam, like that there are people who are Muslims who are moderate, but that's not really what the religion necessarily teaches. And that's how you get this sort of extremist. Maybe you can explain a little bit about jihad and this sort of struggle. And then also, are we infidels or people of the book? Because I've heard both.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting question. I mean, to go just to start with the latter question, Sarah. So to go the term the Quran generally uses, at least in the earlier portions, for Jews and Christians, it refers to us as people of the book. And there's quite a degree of respect for Jews and Christians in those early sort of chapters of the Quran. But then you see what's interesting. If you look what happened in Muhammad's life, if we take the Muslim histories at face value, there's actually quite a lot of critical questions that historians have about their reliability. But we'll put those to one side for a moment and just take the text at face value. When Muhammad starts his preaching career here, he begins in his hometown of Mecca. He doesn't get a lot of following there. He gets a lot of opposition, actually. Mecca is very polytheistic. The Meccans don't like what he's saying about monotheism, and they eventually chase him and his small party of followers out. He emigrates north 200 miles to Medina, and that date of that emigration, actually, 622 AD, is the start date of the Muslim calendar. Muslims date their year one from that day because it's so significant, because at Medina, Muhammad gets into political power. But at Medina, there's a lot of Jewish tribes. When Muhammad arrives, I think he has it in his head that the Jews will welcome him. They'll go, they'll believe his claim to be a prophet, just like the biblical prophets. Hmm. And actually the Jews and the Christians as well, but there were less of them, actually didn't. They went, no, we don't believe you. You're not like us at all. And that caused increasing tension, building up to a point where ultimately Muhammad has one, engages in genocide against one of the tribes and chases the other two out of Medina. And in fact, among his dying words, when Muhammad's on his deathbed dying, one of his last actions is to curse Jews and Christians and to ban them from Arabia, which is why to this day, things like church building and stuff is not actually allowed in Saudi Arabia. That's based upon the final words of Muhammad. So the Quran tracks with that. So earlier on, it's more positive. Later on, you get something like sort of Surah 9, chapter 9, verse 29, of the Quran, which even commands Muslims to fight against Jews and Christians until one of three things happens. Either you kill them, either they submit and become Muslims, or they pay the jizya. And the jizya is a tax that was created in early Islamic thought, jurisprudence, that you could pay that tax as a religious minority. If you were a Jew or a Christian, you could pay a special tax, a sort of head tax, in fact, quite literally a head tax, because if you didn't pay it, you were decapitated. And right. That allowed you to practice your religion.
And so isn't there this Quran idea? I just want to clarify something. You talked about sort of a progression with Muhammad, but isn't the idea in Islam this kind of abrogation that as things get later, they count more? I mean, would you say that's reductionist, but that, the later words of Muhammad are trump the earlier words?
Yeah, exactly. So what you're alluding to is when Muhammad died in 632 AD, the Quran had not been compiled yet. It was a sort of disparate set of pieces. There were a couple of editing projects to kind of try and bring the thing together. And then Muslim theology gets going. And Muslim theologians very quickly discovered, to their horror, that the Quran has, the polite word would be sort of different emphases. The stronger language would be contradictions, passages that outrightly don't say the same thing. A very famous one, Surah 2, 256 says there is no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clearly from error, which seems to say, don't force people, let people believe what they want, because the truth will come out. But then you have Surah 9, verse 5, which says, just fight against the pagans wherever you find them, lie in wait for them and besiege them where they're very stratagem of war. Those two verses don't really fit well together. So Muslim theologians developed this doctrine of abrogation, which says that when you have a contradiction like that, you figure out, using the life, the biography of Muhammad, you look at, use Muhammad's biography to sort of figure out what, which verse in the Quran was revealed when. That gives you a chronology, and that when you have a tension like that, well, there's a very good possibility that the later verse abrogates or supersedes the earlier. And one of the challenges is that a lot of them, those more extreme verses, will be the later ones. Because again, reflecting Muhammad's career, he gets into political power at Medina. It's mm-hmm. Medina, he becomes a warlord and a battle leader, whereas in Mecca, he was in a minority. So yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that a group like ISIS would point to and say, yeah, exactly, right? That's the direction of travel. It's okay for Muslims to be, you know, to be weak and quiet and sort of, you know, on the sidelines when they are a minority. But once you have power, you need to grab power. And the challenge for moderate Muslims, and as I said on that other podcast that I'm involved in, Pod of the Gaps, yeah, there are many moderate Muslims. I know many of them. They are lovely, lovely, lovely people. But with their very greatest respect, I don't often think they have looked into the root of the difficulty. They are moderate in spite of Islam, mm-hmm. not moderate because mm-hmm. of Islam. And that's hard because, say, if you just go in and make that point directly and woodenly, you can damage relationships, you can break friendships. Yeah. You have to find ways of gently opening that up. And one way you can do it is just the how do you know question. When people say, oh, Islam is a religion of peace, well, how do you know? Well, because Muhammad said, well, where did he say that? How do you know that's reliable? Just keep asking that how do you know question, and then find ways to bring Jesus in by contrast.
Okay, so you said bring Jesus in, which is perfect, because my next question was kind of go back and close the loop on an earlier, we started to touch on this. They believe Jesus was a prophet. Talk to us a little bit about what they believe happened at the cross. And then is he coming back? Is someone else coming back? And there was like a switcheroo, or am I confusing that with another religion?
No, you're not at all. So, great question. So Jesus turns up in the Quran because, as I said, Muhammad drew a lot from bits of biblical tradition and stories and material that he found floating around. And Jesus turns up. Muhammad clearly was intrigued by Jesus. There are something like 90 verses in the Quran that talk about Jesus, about 20 or so name him by name. The majority of those, the two biggest sections of those verses would be infancy narratives. So the story of the Annunciation to Mary and the virgin birth and so on, that is told twice at some length in the Quran. Then we have sort of summary verses that tell us that Jesus, you know, healed people, he raised the dead, he preached and taught, that he had disciples. No detail in any of those stories, but just that they're alluded to. And then in chapter 4, verse 157 of the Quran, we have this notorious verse that says that the Jews say that they killed the Messiah, Jesus, the son of Mary, but verily they neither killed nor crucified him, but Allah made it appear to them as if this were the case. And then elsewhere in the Quran, there's an allusion to the idea that Jesus will have some role at the end times. And then later Islamic theology develops that very quickly, within a few centuries, stories in the Hadith with Muhammad reportedly explaining how Jesus will come back at the end of time. He'll fight the Antichrist, will be involved in this great battle at the end of history, and so on. First thing I'd say before we get to what happened, the thing I found the most fascinating is the fact that Jesus of Islam doesn't fit Islamic theology. This is fascinating because he is supposed to be just a prophet. But on the other hand, you know, he's the only Quranic prophet who had a virgin birth. And the Quran doesn't tell you why that happened. He's the only Quranic prophet who does these amazing, spectacular miracles. Muhammad never did a single miracle. In fact, the Quran reports his opponents raising this issue. Jesus did these spectacular miracles. He has these amazing titles in the Quran. He's the Messiah. He's called a word from God, from a God. He's a spirit from God. And then he has this incredible sort of this role at the end of time as well. So he simply doesn't seem to fit. How is it he is just another prophet if he has all this spectacular biography? And in fact, I'm using illustrations. The illustration I use in the book to bring this out, the more I look at Jesus in the Quran, it feels almost exactly the same as if it would feel as if somebody had taken Gandalf from Lord of the Rings and inserted Gandalf into Pride and Prejudice. But suddenly we've got this story of sort of tea parties and sort of sedate romances and, you know, ladies in crinoline dresses and whatnot. And then suddenly you've got a wizard with a staff and doing magic and spectacular things. You'd look at it and go, hang on, he doesn't belong there. Something has gone badly wrong because Gandalf does not belong, in the same world as Elizabeth Bennet. And the Quran feels just like that. Jesus doesn't seem to fit because he's been borrowed from his real home, which is the Bible, where he does fit, and inserted into the Quran where he doesn't. And I love the fact that Jesus is kind of just too big for the Quran. You can't domesticate him. Mm. And I think you can use that actually, you know, in conversations with Muslims to sort of talk about, you know, just look at the Quranic Jesus and start asking questions. And say, look, I think the more I look at this, the more I think we need to turn to the Gospels actually to look at this, to begin to understand why Jesus has these titles, why he's, you know, why he has a role at the end of time, you know, what the virgin birth is all about. As a footnote to that, you mentioned what Muslims believe do happen. Well, the Quran sort of doesn't really answer that question. Many Muslims you meet will have been taught that somebody else was killed in Jesus's place. It's known as the substitution myth, and it developed quite early in Islamic theology. And the idea is that, you know, when the authorities come to arrest Jesus, Allah makes everybody in the room, in the house where Jesus is preaching, look like Jesus. And so they grab the first person they can, who in some versions of the story is Judas. So there's a kind of sort of, you know, sort of justice is done there. And then, you know, he gets killed. He gets crucified all the way crying out, I'm not really the Messiah. I'm not really the Messiah. Sounds like the life of Brian, actually, if you know the Monty Python movie. But I say to Muslims, you know, the problem, of course, with that, if they've been taught that, firstly, of course, it makes Jesus and God involved in deceiving people. The reason there are billions of Christians today is because Jesus deceived people. He lied because he then pretended to be risen from the dead, and his disciples obviously believed it. Mm. You know, at no point did he say, actually, this isn't what happened. Secondly, historically, you still got the issue. Yeah, you've still got the issue of the empty tomb, of course, because, you know, where did the body of Jesus go? And then thirdly, I think I say to Muslims, you end up with a strange thing that you can't trust history. Anything you see, you know, you believe a God may have just made one thing look like another. I mean, how do we even know Muhammad is Muhammad? I mean, you don't know that. Maybe God just made someone look like Muhammad. On the other hand, maybe we take what Jesus said about himself at face value, and then you can take him to the gospel. And of course, Jesus didn't just randomly get killed and risen from the dead. He predicted that would happen multiple times.
So related to that, one of the common questions, because our church happens to be by a community college, which has a lot of international students, many of whom are Muslim from all over the world, Saudi Arabia, Iran, so those two different cultures, right? Northern Africa, all kinds of places. And so sometimes I'm able to have conversations. And one of the questions they have, and it's a good question, I have to admit, I sort of struggle to come up with an answer for it that sort of fully satisfies them for sure, and even me to an extent. Anyway, I try to communicate what I think the problem is that Jesus solves, right? You know, the problem is that we're sinners and he is God in the flesh. He sort of needed to die for the forgiveness of sins. God required that sacrifice of a perfect human being to sort of, you know, satisfy his justice and so on and so forth, his wrath. And they more or less say, well, you know, if God wants to forgive, he can forgive. Why do you need a dead son for that? Like, why do you need a dead God in the flesh for that? And so do you have a kind of pithy answer to that, you know, that sort of kind of explains, you know, why God doesn't just capriciously or arbitrarily, and I think that's kind of the seed, maybe the answer, but he doesn't just capriciously or arbitrarily choose to forgive you. You know, this sacrifice was actually necessary.
This is a chapter in the book.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of one of the chapters
in the book. Yes, I do. But let me say a couple of things. Firstly, it's a great question, Evan. What I'd say, whenever Muslims ask a question, make sure you know for sure, do your best to answer it, but always be thinking just a moment, where is the question coming from? And you've diagnosed this. It comes from this idea in Islam that Allah is arbitrary, and really the chief attribute of Allah in the Quran is will. Allah can just will a thing, and he is supreme power, and even isn't really constrained by his own promises. I've had Muslims say to me, well, God would never actually make a promise or a covenant because he would then have restricted himself. But you can, of course, also turn the question back on Muslims and say, well, I'm happy to answer it. But of course, the same applies to you, my friend, because to go, you believe that Allah wants you to keep all these strange arbitrary commands in order to gain merit to go to heaven. I mean, praying five times a day, he's the God of the universe. He doesn't care what you pray five times a day. I mean, he's got better things. He's got universe to run. And what's all this business going to Mecca? I mean, you know, God created, you know, Allah created the world. Has he not heard of climate change? I mean, think of the carbon footprint of the Hajj. Did, you know, what does Allah need you going to Mecca for? Don't be ridiculous. And you can actually run the same thing and make them, because in their world, their system makes perfect sense and they can't understand the Christian one. So you can definitely shake their cage a bit. They will probably fall back on, well, Allah just said it and that's good enough for me to go, okay, that's fair enough. Or actually, as Christians, that's actually a perfectly good answer. If God just said, this is what I require and this is what it required Jesus to do, there is a degree to which I go, well, God is God, actually. But I think we can go more than that as Christians. And we can say, look, there are two issues with the character of God that I think are in tension in Islam. And it's the idea that God is a judge and God is merciful. Now, you know, you've heard by now, I tend to like use analogies because I think it helps people understand complex ideas. And so, you know, the courtroom analogy, that if you, step out of your little podcast studio and the police arrest you on the way out because they've just discovered that crime you committed last week, and you're dragged tomorrow morning before a hastily convened court, tried by a jury of your peers, found guilty. The judge peers down at you from her bench and she says, Evan, according to the law, there in a, where are you, Texas, aren't you? You owe this 30 years in prison for the crime you've committed. And I'm a judge who believes in being just. So bang, then down to the get goes the gavel, 30 years you get. Now that judge has been just, right? She's mm-hmm. followed the law to the letter. You've done the crime, you're doing the time. Has she been merciful? No, not one iota of mercy is shown there. She simply dispensed justice. Well, now rerun the script. You get arrested, brought before the judge, tried, found guilty, because clearly you did the crime. And this time the judge peers down at you from her bench and says, well, actually, Evan, according to the law of Texas, you should get 30 years in prison for this crime. But you know what? Today is Thursday. I like Thursdays. I'm feeling merciful this morning, so I'm going to let you go. You can get out of my courtroom before I change my mind. And of course, you'd run out of that court as fast as your little legs would carry you. The judge has been merciful. She's let you off 30 years. But has she been just? Well, no, she hasn't. She's ignored the law. She's ignored the crime. She's ignored the need for a penalty and reparation. She's ignored the victims. She has not been just. And if your newspapers are like ours, the headlines the following day would not be liberal judge lets Texas serial killer go free, but will be lunatic liberal, you know, lets Evan free to kill again or something. Mm-hmm. And those are the two things that need reconciling. I think Islam, at its very best when it talks about mercy, even the passages of the Quran that do that with some beauty and in the language, they miss the fact that, well, if God simply forgives us, it's in the position of that latter judge. He's overlooked justice. He's not a God who is just. He might be merciful, but he's not just. Mm. But equally, if he just punishes us and doesn't offer mercy, he's a God who is just, who's judge and just, but isn't merciful. The cross brings those two things together because it says God hasn't offered us forgiveness at the expense of his justice, but through his justice, with God in Jesus actually offering to step into the gap and say, justice requires that punishment be done. Something has to be done to ensure that there is justice, because if God doesn't uphold justice, then that's the end of any hope in the universe. And talk to anyone who's suffered a crime or injustice, take away the hope of justice and all hope fails. Mm-hmm. God forgives us in Christianity through Jesus without overlooking justice. I think Islam has a justice problem, quite frankly. I don't think it grapples with the problem of justice. It's quite a naive, simple theology that I don't think works in the real world. And funnily enough, I was criticizing Miroslav Volf earlier for his book on Allah, A Christian Response, but he also has written profoundly on justice and judgment. He comes from Eastern Europe, the Balkan region of Europe, which was beset by horrific civil war and ethnic cleansing and so on. And he's written in many places about how that changed his whole view, because he was inclined to perhaps more liberal Christianity when he was younger, you know, thinking, well, you know, do I want to believe in a God of wrath and a God of judgment? But he said, my people went through that experience of war and genocide, he said, I suddenly realized that it's not good enough. In fact, only in a comfortable liberal home could you ever come up with the idea that a God of justice is a bad thing. When you've experienced, you know, your brother being killed, your sister being raped, your village being burnt to the ground, you need to know that there is a God of justice who is not going to simply go, it's okay, there's nothing here to see, move on. And I think the powerful thing about the cross, it tells us God has it covered. And it also instantly reminds us how bad my sin is and your sin. I think Islam plays fast and loose with sin too, actually. The cross reminds me of just what a stinking rotter I can be and how much I actually need that. A pat on the head is not enough.
Yeah, man, when I hear you talk, I mean, I already thought this, I'm squarely on Team Jesus, but it just makes me feel like when you compare the two religions, one leaves you full of hope and freedom. you know, when I hear you talk about Islam, I think there must just be this constant inner turmoil going on if you really believe all the tenets of it. But did we lose you for a second? You're still there?
No, I'm still here. Okay, sorry, I was perfect. That was my thoughtful face.
Okay. Just making sure. Sadly, we are out of time. I had all these quick fire questions I was going to fire at you, asking you about like Ishmael, asking you about the demonic verses. Do you speak Arabic?
No, I read Arabic. My modern standard Arabic is terrible, so I couldn't go into a, you know, Lebanese restaurant and order lunch. But I can read the Quran quite happily.
Okay, interesting. Well, that's the only way you can read the true Quran, right? I mean,
according to Islamic theology, yes. Most Muslims, it's only the true Quran in Arabic. Otherwise, it's just a translation.
Yeah. So we'll have to maybe have you back on later for all these quick fire questions I thought of mid podcast. But I will tell people, especially if you have Muslim friends and you don't feel yet equipped, I mean, maybe read this book together, you know, like grab the book, Do Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God, and read it yourself and invite them to read it with you and then just discuss it. Cause I think the book is, it stands with conviction, but it's gentle. And so I really appreciate it. And I love having you on. If people are interested in learning more about you or challenging you or hitting you up with a question, is there a way that people can reach you? Do you have like an email or should they just go?
Yeah, search you up on Google? Find me is, Sarah, if they just Google me on either Google me or Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, those kind of social media platforms. I'm on all of them. Just Google Andy Bannister, you'll probably find me. And if that fails, you can Google the organization I work for, SOLAS, that's SOLAS, which is the Scottish word, the Gaelic word for light. And you'll find us. And as I say, we hang out on social media, myself, and my colleagues, always happy to take a question or any of those things. So yeah, do reach out to if you want to talk more.
You have a Presbyterian and a Lutheran here. So we're well acquainted.
Well, there's got to be a joke there, isn't there? A Presbyterian, a Lutheran, and a Baptist do a podcast.
What is that?
Subscribe to Part of the Gaps. I just did it.
Very good. There we go. Yes, Part of the Gaps.
Supposed to tell people that into your podcast to our podcast. Provider.
Oh, yeah. Subscribe to both podcasts.
Yes. If you want to hear the cool accents, for sure, check them out. And then, you know, come on our podcast because we need your love too. So, yeah. But yeah, perfect. And yeah, I accosted Andy on Facebook and he actually said yes to coming on the podcast. So he actually is on social media. It's great.
There you go. That is living proof, right? That I do actually respond to messages eventually.
Yeah, it was like the persistent widow. It was like the 100th time, but still. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been wonderful. And I think really helpful too for those that are in relationships with Muslims. So we'll have to have you back on. But until we see you guys again on Theology on Air, we encourage you as always to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.